More than 150 years after its publication, Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species is still admired by scientists, vilified by fundamentalists, and discussed in almost every biology class. Darwin may be a household name, but how many of us have actually read his work? Although The Origin is full of elegant insights and its publication was a path-breaking moment in modern science, it can be inaccessible to all but the most determined of readers. To rectify that, David N. Resnick, a professor of biology at the University of California, Riverside, has written a 21st century guide to Darwin's book and its times called The Origin, Then and Now, an interpretive guide to the origin of species. It's published by Princeton University Press, and I'm pleased that it brings David N. Resnick to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
When you first read The Origin of Species, did you ever suspect that you'd spend as much time writing about it?
No. I read it right after graduating from my undergraduate program, where I decided that I was going to be an evolutionary biologist, even though I didn't know what evolution was at the time. And it mystified me. I didn't really understand it.
Well, I've met a fair number of Marxists who've never really read Capital, and I'm assuming that there are a lot of scientists who are willing to learn about Darwin secondhand because the textbooks tell us everything we need to know.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there are many scientists who haven't read it, probably most.
So why go to the source? Is there something to be learned there that you can't learn in other ways?
Yeah, it turns out that there are big elements of The Origin of Species that got lost in the shuffle and the transition to what we call the modern synthesis that happened in the 1930s.
What was his main goal for writing The Origin of Species?
To propose a new theory. He wanted to be the equivalent of Isaac Newton for the life sciences. So he had big ambitions when he wrote the book.
Although Newton was a lot more forthcoming, wasn't Darwin kind of reluctant, at least at first, to publish the book or even work on it?
No, he was not reluctant to work on it. He did. There's a 15-year delay between his developing the concept and his publishing the book. And there are not various ideas for why he held on to it for so long. A lot of it was that he knew he was overturning established science. He had seen there's sort of a popular version of evolution that was published in 1844, and he saw how vilified it was. And I think he procrastinated, that he wanted to be perfect. And he was working on what would have been a 1,200 or 1,500-page book at the time that he decided instead to write The Origin.
Hadn't his grandfather, Erasmus, been an early proponent of evolution?
Yeah, he was. He wrote sort of epic poems about evolution.
What did evolution mean in the 18th century when Erasmus was writing about it?
It meant the key word was transmutation, that new species could come into existence and that one species could become another over time. But that was it. It wasn't, you know, that falls far short of what Darwin presented.
Well, Lamarck was also talking about something like that.
That's right. That's right. And so Lamarck and Erasmus were sort of on equal footing in terms of their perspectives on evolution.
Was Darwin born into a wealthy family?
Yeah, they were upper middle class. They weren't royalty, but his father was a doctor and a investor and was wealthy. Plus his in-laws were the Wedgwoods of the Wedgwood Pottery family, and so they were quite wealthy.
So he didn't really have to do any work. He could have lived a rather leisurely life if he'd wanted to.
That's right, as his brother did.
Did his family encourage his interest in biology?
His father, well, at least when the opportunity for the voyage came up, his father originally did not favor it. His Uncle Wedgwood did, convinced his father this is something he should do, and his father supported him wholeheartedly after that.
Well, Wedgwood, his wife, was rather religious, wasn't she? In fact, wasn't
she
kind of worried that he was going to go to hell for his ideas?
That part I haven't heard, but she was quite religious, and so that would have been his risk. I think in the end, I never heard her expressing any worry that he might go to hell.
I just saw this movie, and
I saw that movie too,
And I believed it.
The movie colored some things.
Well, when Darwin's name comes up today, it's often in the context of a discussion about science and religion.
Yeah.
Was he a religious man?
He was in his youth, more so probably than his father. They were Church of England, and they were sort of liberal in their views. His father has been described as a near atheist. But Darwin was certainly more religious than his father was. In the end of his life, it's less clear. He actually writes some colorful things about
it. Do you think that one of the reasons he took so long was that he recognized that his theories might be perceived as an attack on religion?
He certainly, I think, would have been troubled by the religious aspect of it. But I think people don't understand that he was more concerned about the scientific community. And in his day, science and religion were intertwined in a way that they aren't now. So, for example, when he was at Cambridge, all of his professors were ordained ministers in the Church of England. Everyone who received a degree had to be a member of the Church of England. And so science and religion were one in a way that they aren't now. And his opposition to things like special creation really were addressing the scientific community more than the religious community.
But did he have any goals for an academic career of his own?
I mean,
it wouldn't really have mattered if he was an atheist or not, if he didn't want to teach.
Yeah, academic careers were not as readily available as they are now. I think the original intent was that he would actually be a minister in the Church of England and that it really would be a way for him to have a legitimate job as a middle-class guy and then to pursue his interest in natural history. You'll see that many of the science that was written in his day was written by reverends. So they were naturalists in the same way that Darwin was. But he gave up on that while on the voyage of the Beagle. He toyed with the idea, but by the time he got back to England, that was not an option anymore for him.
Was Charles Lyell a member of the clergy?
No. He was not a professor either. He actually had a law degree.
But his ideas influenced Darwin's observations while he was on the Beagle.
Yeah, profoundly. And the way they did is that Lyell's view of geology was that processes that we see going on right in front of us on a day-to-day basis can explain big things. We can understand the Grand Canyon by looking at running water or the wind or ice or other things. And so we didn't have to invoke anything outside of our day-to-day experience to understand geology. And Darwin applied that same idea to biology. He actually was a geologist first. I mean, that's how influenced he was by Lyell.
My guest is David N. Resnick, R-E-Z-N-I-C-K. His book, The Origin, Then and Now, An Interpretive Guide to the Origin of Species, published by Princeton University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is Darwin a good writer?
Yeah, he's a very good writer, and you could see him getting better and better. I've read things like The Voyage of the Beagle in the 1838, and the 1842, and the 1860 version. And certainly the 1860 version, that's one I chose to quote just because his writing was much better.
Well, why did you choose to reorganize the chapter order in your book?
Because there's a strong difference between how he thought about things then versus now. That's the then and now part, that we know a lot more about evolution now. And one of the things that he did is he kind of smeared natural selection and speciation together as a continuum. And in modern biology, we separate them out. So there's scientists who devote their whole careers to just natural selection or just speciation. And so I was trying to make it more current in the way I presented it.
Is that because he didn't understand the whole process or just because he was trying to make a case?
That's a good point. He understood the whole process and now we understand it better. The science is a dynamic discipline, and so our ideas have grown. And in particular, our idea of what a species is different from what it was in 1859.
Well, he did get some things wrong, didn't he? Or by modern science standards.
Yeah. Right and wrong, it's not that black and white. One of the interesting things to me is to try to judge what people did in the context in which they did it. And so it's possible to say that something was right in 1859 but is wrong now. But he did get some things wrong. I could tell you what he got wrong also.
Well, it's the same sort of thing as Newton, who got everything right, but then Einstein came along and said, well, there is another way of looking at
that. It's exactly like Newton. That's a perfect analogy.
When and under what circumstances did he come to the idea of natural selection? Is that something that occurred on the Beagle?
No, it was in 1838. It was after the Beagle voyage, and it was after people – in the Beagle voyage, he funded himself, and one of the consequences was that all his collections were his own, and he brought back huge collections, and then he used
them – He was kind of famous, wasn't he, or by that time?
Yeah, by the time he got back –
Because of his letters to the Beagle?
Yeah, he was already well-known because he was sending home these long letters – And the letters ended up being sent to his professors in Cambridge and being read in scientific meetings. And so he didn't realize it, but he was a celebrity. But then he took all his collections and he used them as calling cards to gain an in to the inner circles of science, because at that point he was a Cambridge undergraduate who had gone on a voyage. You know, so he wasn't established yet.
And a listener suggests that he was incredibly shy.
No. The image of Darwin before, there are two sides of Darwin's life. In his youth, he apparently was outgoing, he was congenial, he was well-liked, he was socially well-connected. And it was after his illness and after his marriage, when he moved out to Downhouse, he became much more reclusive.
And his children also had illness. Was there some concern about the fact that he'd married his first cousin?
He was very concerned about that. In fact, he wrote about the importance of outbreeding in The Origin of Species. He even tried to get a question put on the census of 1871 to ask, are you married to your cousin? Because he wanted to then use that to compile statistics about how many children they had to see if there was a signal that you could find.
Was he aware of Gregor Mendel's work?
He was not.
So he was coming to a lot of the same ideas without that as a confirmation.
He didn't come to the same ideas as Gregor Mendel. That's the one place where you could say he was spectacularly wrong in terms of his ideas about inheritance worked, how inheritance works. And it's an interesting thing because today we say everyone must understand genetics to understand evolution, but Darwin didn't understand genetics, and yet he got it right. And one of the things I tried to address in my book is how did he get it right? Because it defines the minimal things that you need to know to get the right answer.
He witnessed an earthquake in Chile while he was on the voyage of the Beagle.
Right.
Did that play a role in his theories of where species came from?
It played a role in his adopting Lyell's concept of things that you see happening in day-to-day life can create big changes. Because in the earthquake, he saw an elevation of the harbor in Valparaiso. And then he saw above the harbor other fossils of animals that were still found on the shoreline. He saw mussels on fresh rocks now 5 feet above the waterline, whereas they were below the waterline the day before. Then he saw fossils 30 feet, and then he saw fossils of 14,000 feet in the Andes, and he put that together.
I don't know if you know that Leonardo found shells on hilltops and came to the conclusion that the hills of Rome had once been covered by water, but wrote that in his backward handwriting because he was afraid that would get him in trouble. People were thinking these things.
Yeah,
knew that. And Darwin was not alone in thinking along these lines. What were other people doing about this? Why were they missing the big picture?
Well, here you're talking about geology, and they didn't miss the big picture in geology. I mean, that was the sort of thing that Lyell did. The big picture in evolution, it's hard to say. I mean, there's so many steps that he took to get to where he did. I mean, that's why Darwin remains a great name. That's why The Origin remains a book that has current value. It's not a historical document solely.
Well, you say that his contemporaries were picking at the scab of humankind.
that was Michael Ruse's. He wrote the introduction. I'm not so graphic. But, the part of the dangerous implication of The Origin of Species was that man is part of the animal kingdom. And that was a very difficult thing. Lyell never really entirely warmed up to that, even though Lyell accepted evolution. Huxley embraced it wholeheartedly. But it was a mystery. How do we fit into the natural world? And are we a special creation, or are we just another animal?
People were collecting fossils and specimens at that time.
Yeah.
And
for a long time before then.
Yeah. What were they thinking?
Well, at first, it was not accepted that they necessarily were once alive. I mean, one idea was that these were just I don't know how you would explain them, but they were images of living things that were never alive. Then by about
that God had planted?
Well, yeah. I mean, that was one of the ideas that was proposed. Darwin commented on that very colorfully in The Origin. By about 1820, George Cuvier was proved to everyone's acceptance that these were animals that were extinct, that life had existed that no longer was found on the earth. And that was a troubling thing, because if animals are special creations of God, why would they ever be destroyed? But up to the time of The Origin, the idea of extinction was still debated as to how they fit into the bigger picture and why things went extinct. Thomas Jefferson, for example, thought that animals in the fossil record that weren't around actually were alive, that there's so much of the Earth that was unexplored that when he dispatched Lewis and Clark to explore the interior, he expected to see mastodons and mammoths and woolly rhinoceroses. Lamarck proposed that animals were not extinct, that they had evolved. People don't realize that that was Lamarck's idea, that his idea of evolution was to explain fossils that aren't represented among living animals today. So there were competing ideas for extinction and what fossils meant.
And what we were taught in high school was that Lamarck believed that giraffes developed their long necks because generation after generation stretched to get to the leaves at the top of the trees.
Yeah, he actually saw two different forces. One was that the desire, the force to be something, and the other was a complexifying force, that all life, he thought life was created repeatedly as small, simple things, and that became more complex and bigger over time.
You say that Darwin saw nature as a jigsaw puzzle. What do you mean by that?
Meaning that all of the organisms that you find in a community are interacting with each other. And so if you picture, you know, he had one example of beehives are attacked by mice, and bees fertilize flowers, and cats eat mice. And so the abundance of flowers in a neighborhood could be increased by having cats in the area, because cats eat the mice, there are more bees, there's more pollination. So the general idea is that all organisms are tightly interacting and that nature is packed with things that rely on each other. And he said that these interactions among organisms is actually what shapes evolution.
He noticed that a species could live in captivity far outside its range. What did that suggest to him?
That told him that animal distributions were not limited by their physical environment, that they're limited by their biotic environment, by their interactions with other organisms. And so he thought the physical environment played a minor role in shaping how animals evolved.
Why was Darwin trying so hard to come up with laws instead of just explaining each phenomenon individually?
He said that his career was to amass facts and grind out unifying concepts. In other words, it was the Newtonian idea. It was the idea that there are, you know, uniform or widely applicable principles that dictate what the Earth is like.
Well, how did scientists before Darwin explain variations within a species?
They didn't. It was an annoyance to them. I mean, you know, one of the big ventures before Darwin was to classify species, and variations are noise. They're things that make it hard to classify. Darwin, actually, one of his biggest innovations that people don't realize was to focus on the importance of individual variation and saying that this is the fuel for evolutionary change. And he created whole new disciplines by doing that.
Well, the question many people ask naively is, why do different breeds of dogs look so different from each other, be of different sizes, and yet they are all part of the same species and they can interbreed?
Right. Yeah, the point that he made there was that because of these individual variations, a breeder who desired an animal's certain attributes, like a dachshund that was shaped like a sausage, could, by studying a large population of dogs, pick those ones that had the attributes that he wanted, make them the parents of the next generation, and do that repeatedly and accumulate change and generate breeds that were quite distinct.
On the other hand, we can have different kinds of finches that look very much alike but cannot interbreed.
That's right. Appearance is not necessarily a good indication of whether or not you're the same species.
My guest is David N. Resnick, who has written The Origin, Then and Now, An Interpretive Guide to the Origin of Species. It's written with an introduction by Michael Roos and published by Princeton University Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with David N. Resnick, a professor of biology at the University of California, Riverside. He has written a book called The Origin, Then and Now, An Interpretive Guide to the Origin of Species. It is published by Princeton University Press. What did Darwin mean by the term monstrosity?
Monstrosities were what we would call a mutation, but it's a mutation that has a large impact on the appearance of the individual. And it's something that could appear spontaneously. His favorite example is the Ancon sheep. It was a kind of sheep that had a mutation that caused it to have short legs.
Did he think that large changes like that were the main causes of evolution?
No. He rejected them as a source of evolution because they were rare, they were unpredictable, and they often were deleterious.
Do sudden mutations ever actually make a species better adapted to its environment?
I'm sorry, I missed that question.
We have there are mutations and there are mutations.
Right.
There seem to be these slow ones, and then there are these really big ones.
Yeah.
Do they really work?
Yeah, they really work. I mean, they are the universal source of the genetic variation that natural selection acts upon. It's the fuel of evolutionary change. In Darwin's day, people didn't recognize that there was a continuity between mutations that had little effects and were very subtle or might not change things much at all versus ones that had big effects.
Didn't people see the connection between what they were doing with domesticated animals and, as you said earlier, and breeding dogs with what Darwin was talking about?
Apparently not. It's an interesting thing. Wallace didn't use domestication as an analogy. And most often people thought that domestication was like stretching a rubber band, meaning that as soon as you ceased stretching it would pop back to what it was to begin with. So Darwin was quite original in that.
What is the modern synthesis and how does it help us understand Darwin's original writings?
Okay, so Darwin's idea, the mechanism of natural selection was largely rejected by around 1900, even though evolution was accepted. The modern synthesis represents an interval from about 1930 to 1950 where natural selection was rehabilitated and came back as what we recognize as one of the main causes of evolutionary change.
But New York played a role in that.
New York played a major role in it, yeah. The major three major books of the modern synthesis were written by Ernst Mayr from the American Museum of Natural History, George Gaylord Simpson, also from the American Museum, and Theodosius Dobzhansky from Columbia University. But what they did was to reconcile Mendelian inheritance with evolution by natural selection. Believe it or not, those two were, when Mendelian inheritance was rediscovered in 1900, it became used as an argument against natural selection, as a plausible mechanism of evolution. And you actually see there's a well-established school of scientists who were studying natural selection up to 1900. They adhered to a theory of inheritance that was what we'd call blending inheritance. And as they lost the battle over inheritance, they also, natural selection kind of died as an innocent bystander.
Because Mendelian theory suggests a certain stability, a certain continuity,
no,
as opposed to changes?
No, Mendelian theory was in a continuum in the minds of those people with what you called monstrosities. Mendel's peas were taller, they were short. His flowers were redder, they were white. His peas were wrinkled or they were smooth. The point is it was discrete steps and changes, whereas Darwin always talked about gradual, continuous change. And so it seemed like it was inconsistent.
Is the modern synthesis the way we understand evolution today?
Yes, it is. I mean, there have been some modifications of it. We don't understand it quite in the same way that they understood it in the 1930s, but it represents the rehabilitation of natural selection as one of the key mechanisms.
Haven't you studied populations of guppies in your research?
Yes, I have.
Were you testing one of Darwin's predictions?
It wasn't one of Darwin's predictions, but it was a prediction of sort of a modernized version of evolutionary theory that began to develop in the 1950s. And what I wanted to do, you know, the general attitude at the time that I did my work was that evolution can explain many things, but it's too slow to observe. We only can see it through the lens of history. And for various reasons in the 1970s, I decided that maybe that wasn't right and that actually evolution was visible and that it would be possible to do experiments in nature and see evolution happen and test predictions.
Isn't that why others came up with the theory of punctuated equilibrium?
No. The punctuated equilibrium was based upon the fossil record.
And suddenly we have these big leaps.
These big leaps. And so one of the things that I did was to measure the rate of evolution in real time in an experiment done in nature. And when I scaled my rate of evolution with what they thought was fast in the fossil record, it turns out that I was seeing change that was 10,000 to 10 million times faster than a punctuation. Now, Gould argued that punctuations could not be explained by natural selection because natural selection is gradual and continuous, and punctuations look like, you know, a punctuation, rapid change. And then what I did was come back and say, well, no, actually, natural selection is so much faster than a punctuation that you shouldn't ask why it's so fast. What you should ask is, why is it so slow?
You said that your research on guppies led to one of your proudest moments in science.
That's right. That was to be featured in the National Enquirer.
Of all places.
My second proudest moment was to be featured in an essay by Stephen Jay Gould after I came out with that statement about rates of evolution.
Mm-hmm. Did he buy your argument?
He did not. He said he referred to it as the paradox of the visibly irrelevant. And by that, what he meant was that since I showed that natural selection was so much faster, that evolution by natural selection was so much faster than what you see in the fossil record, that it could not account for what you saw in the fossil record. I call this the Goldilocks phenomenon, which is that first natural selection was too cold and then natural selection was too hot, but whatever it may have been, it wasn't right, because Gould was trying to say that something other than natural selection is important in dictating the history of evolution.
You've devoted an entire chapter to the mosquitoes of the London Underground. How are they related to Darwin's ideas?
The London Underground dates to the 1860s, and it turns out that a mosquito from the surface, Culex pipiens, invaded the underground, and what some investigators showed in the late 1990s was that they were verging on becoming distinct species from the surface populations that they were derived from, which means that between 1860 and 1998, we were witnessing maybe not the formation of a new species, but certainly a significant march towards the formation of a new species.
Because the environment of the underground is different than the rest of the city?
Yeah, the surface populations get their blood from birds. There aren't any birds in the underground, and so those guys got their blood from rats and people. You know, they switched to mammals. But then many other things are different. The underground is continuously warm, whereas the surface has a winter. So the winter ones go into a diapause, and the underground ones do not. The surface ones need blood to produce eggs. The underground ones do not. They can produce eggs without a blood meal. We assume that the rats and the humans are sometimes in short supply. But there are other things about them that seem to be making them close to being completely reproductively isolated now.
Does this only happen in London? We have mosquitoes in New York. We have a subway system. We have rats down and people down bottom and birds above ground?
They may well be there. The cave mosquito, that phenomena is actually found in many places. That particular species in many other areas has adapted to cave environments, and many of the cave populations have similar attributes to the ones in the London Underground.
So are they a new species?
Probably not. Like in Spain, the climatic difference between the cave and the surface is not nearly as dramatic, and so you don't have the diapause in any of the populations, and the diapause is one of the things that probably keeps them apart. But some of them may well be what some people would call new species. Many of them may be new species, according to some definitions.
My guest is David N. Resnick. His book, The Origin, Then and Now, An Interpretive Guide to the Origin of Species, it's published by Princeton University Press. And people who still resist or evolution deniers say that this is just a theory.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Well, I'd like to tell them to go look at a dictionary and find out what the word theory means, because it has many definitions. And the colloquial definition is that it means, you know, speculation. The scientific definition is quite different. You've heard of the theory of relativity, right? You've never seen a headline that says relativity, fact, or fiction, have you? You know, the point is that in day-to-day speech, we use the word theory, and in some contexts, everyone would assume that relativity is fact. And yet it's a theory. The idea is that theory, if you look it up in the dictionary, when a scientist uses the word theory, what he means is that it's an articulation of general principles that enable you to explain or unite a diversity of phenomena under a single explanatory framework. And so even presidents and Supreme Court justices seem to have missed the point of what it means when we call it a theory.
Are some of Darwin's predictions and theories being tested today?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he spawned many new subdisciplines. I can point to, you know, two-page segments of The Origin of Species that are today represented by multiple societies and professional journals. And yes, they're being tested today. But they're also expanded today. Everything that was a single, simple, streamlined idea in Darwin's day has often diversified into many different related ideas.
People like Nietzsche extrapolated into discussions of human evolution. Did Darwin address the question of human evolution in The Origin of Species?
Not in The Origin. He did in later books. He published a book called The Descent of Man, and there he talked a lot about the importance of sexual selection in shaping human characters. Sexual selection was an alternative to natural selection.
Did he live to see people bend his ideas to support eugenics and social Darwinism?
It probably was beginning about then, 1883. It didn't really blossom until like the late 19th century and early 20th century. So there might have been a little bit of it going on then. Certainly the idea of social Darwinism developed during his lifetime.
Do researchers today try to explain human behavior in terms of evolution?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what E.O. Wilson was the first to do it in a very prominent public way with this book, Sociobiology, which didn't get a good reception, but now it's taken in stride.
What happened at the time? I remember this probably apocryphal story about the bishop's wife saying, Have you heard that this man's come up with an idea that we descended from the apes? I hope it's not true, but if it is, I hope nobody learns about it.
And I didn't hear that. I'm sure many people said that kind of thing.
But did he find himself embattled? Did he have to defend his ideas constantly?
I think he was seriously embattled, but, you know, he lived in this fortress, you know, his country home. Not really a fortress, but maybe that's one of the reasons why he was reclusive and why he controlled his social interactions. He mostly responded through the pen, but he also had others who, you know, who were his defenders, like Thomas Huxley, for example, Darwin's bulldog, was very big on talking about human origins. He took on Richard Owen, who had been Darwin's friend and mentor, and then really turned against Darwin after The Origin came out. No one was trying to argue for special attributes of humans, and Huxley was arguing that, no, there weren't special attributes of humans. He even organized public dissections, if you can imagine such a thing, of dissecting the brain in public of a chimp or a gorilla to show that the structures of its brain were the same as humans.
Didn't Huxley say, it's so obvious, why didn't I think of it?
Yes, he did.
But there is that whole story about Russell coming up with a similar idea and Darwin feeling like he was pressured to publish.
Yeah. Well, at the beginning of the interview, I talked about the big book, his strive for perfection. He called The Origin an abstract, and he wrote it in response to Alfred Russel Wallace's similar abstract, and Wallace forced
his hand. I knew there
was
a Russell in that
name.
Yeah,
there is a Russell. Yeah, so Wallace forced his hand, and so Darwin took what would have been his big book, this large thing, and condensed it down into this 480-page abstract.
Did he ever write the 480 is a pretty big book, but did he ever write the big book?
No, his publisher said that, you know, The Origin's selling really well, the big book's just going to cut into those sales, why do it? And so Darwin, what he did instead was to, his goal originally was to take all the big facets of the big book and turn them into other big books. And so he wrote in 1868 a two-volume book on Variation Under Domestication, which was an expansion of that part of the big book. But then he never completed that task.
Domestication, because that was something that people could understand?
Right. Yeah, and it was something that people did.
By the time he died, were his ideas generally accepted in the scientific community?
Evolution was accepted. Natural selection was doing okay when he died, but it got worse after he died. Certainly by 1909, the 50th anniversary, natural selection was very much on the ropes. Even Thomas Huxley didn't openly accept natural selection. Michael Ruse went and looked back at all the final exams that Huxley wrote at what became University College London, and he never asked about evolution on his biology exams.
Are you surprised that this is something that's still subject to debate?
Yeah, I am. It's a culture that I grew up with, and so it's hard to say that I'm surprised because it's been part of my background. You know, I mean, every American hears about it. But on the other hand, it's sort of dismaying that it has so much of a source of debate. One of my motives in writing the book was to make the ideas more accessible to an audience that was interested in knowing what evolution's all about.
Well, modern biology could not exist without some of the basic ideas here. People take the drugs that come out of that work and yet deny that there's any link between the two.
That's true. But, you know, everyone says that you have to know evolution to know biology. And many biologists don't know evolution. You can be a perfectly good practicing biologist and do great things without understanding evolution. And yet you're right. Evolution is part of our everyday lives in ways that people don't fully appreciate.
I'm sure you want people to read your book, but should they try to read the original?
I guess. I definitely think it's worth trying. It was hard for me to do, and yet I've met many people who said that they read it and they found it easy. They may be smarter than I am. I don't know. But I think it's something that's worth trying.
David N. Resnick is a professor of biology at the University of California, Riverside. His book, The Origin, Then and Now, An Interpretive Guide to the Origin of Species, with an introduction by Michael Ruse. It is published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.